It is Monday, September the 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, could a UN meeting on North Korea sanctions be more U.S. maximum pressure?
No, unfortunately not. That the whole idea of maximum pressure died. And it probably actually died the day Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un shook hands.
Powerful storm hits the U.S. southeast, costing farmers all they've got.
Statewide in both states, North Carolina, South Carolina, it could be billions of dollars.
Also ahead, remembering the global financial crisis of 10 years ago, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. The United States has called an urgent meeting of the UN Security Council for later today in response to what it says are efforts by some countries to undermine and obstruct sanctions against North Korea. The U.S. did not name any countries, but the American ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, accused Russia. In a meeting with reporters, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was asked about the push from Moscow and Beijing to lessen sanctions on North Korea.
I spoke with Ambassador Haley about this earlier today. Russia has actively attempted to undermine the UN Security Council resolutions, the work of the 1718 Committee, the committee at the UN that evaluates compliance with sanctions. By attempting to change the language there. I hope that the 1718 committee will do what it has historically done, remain independent and report on the facts as it know it, and not allow a single country, in this case Russia, to draft language and have it inserted. I hope they will publish the original document that they intended to publish, which shows clear activities related to sanctions and sanctions violations. It's important. It's the data set that underlays not American sanctions, but the world sanctions from the UN Security Council. Your question was broader than just that. The United States is as committed as ever to continuing to enforce those UN Security Council resolutions. We believe they are central to President Trump's efforts to convince Chairman Kim that full final denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula is necessary and that it needs to be done in a way that the world can see that there's been this strategic change in Chairman Kim's core understanding of how he will provide a better future for the North Korean people. He said it at the summit in Singapore, and we are still continuing to have many conversations with the DPRK about how to effectuate achieving all the commitments that were made during the Singapore summit.
VOA's Victor Beatty asked Harry Kasianis, Director of Defense Studies at the Center for the National Interest, if the UN Security Council talks today will make any progress.
No, unfortunately not, that the whole idea of maximum pressure died. And it probably actually died the day Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un shook hands. When you have a visual like that, when you have, you know, the world press sort of going goo-goo and gaga over, you know, Donald Trump shaking this dictator's hand, that has a legitimizing impact. When you also bring in the fact that the United States has already placed about $50 billion worth of tariffs on Chinese goods, and potentially it was about to tariff another $200 billion worth of Chinese goods, China really has no impetus to really participate anymore in the maximum pressure campaign. So if you combine those two things together, really the whole idea of maximum pressure is going to start to fade away in the background. And that actually could push Donald Trump to doing a lot more in North Korea in terms of being much more flexible. So I think there's actually a lot of changes that are going to happen on U.S. policy in the coming days and weeks ahead.
Regarding President Trump, one of his picks for the ambassadorship to South Korea, which did not go through, he withdrew the name, Victor Cha of the Center for Strategic International Studies, is now suggesting that the president should agree to separate talks for a formal peace on the Korean Peninsula from the issue of denuclearization. What say you?
Well, Victor Cha is a gentleman and a scholar, and he's one of the best in the world, and I've read his work on that front, and I think he's absolutely correct. I think what the United States needs to do, though, is to really offer North Koreans a little bit of incentive. There's this whole problem of who is going to go first in terms of making a big push for denuclearization. Is it North Korea maybe offering up a nuclear weapon or some sort of a listing of its nuclear weapons? Or is it the United States that goes first and offers some sort of peace declaration? What I say to do is the United States and South Korea should offer a peace declaration to North Korea. It could be signed at the UN General Assembly in the coming weeks in New York when the Assembly is about to gather. And I think that really would say to Kim Jong-un, look, we've done everything we can to make you feel secure that we're not going to invade you, that we're not going to invoke regime change, that we're not going to attack you in any way. And we've done everything possible to sort of make you feel that you can come into the international arena. But now the ball is in your court. You need to make a move to do something to denuclearize. And I think that would put a lot of pressure on Kim to make a substantial move. If after three meetings with Mike Pompeo at the UN, if after a summit with Donald Trump, if after a peace declaration, Kim still won't make any move to denuclearize, I think we know the game is up, and I think we know we have to move on and change our strategy. But I think it would put a lot of pressure on Kim to really make a big move.
Big week this week as the third inter-Korean summit gets underway, this time in Pyongyang. This comes amid falling public opinion polls for President Moon Jae-in of South Korea. Apparently there's not much progress that can be shown this year so far on the area of denuclearization. What's at stake here?
I think a lot's at stake. I think President Moon has invested a tremendous amount of political capital to try and figure out some way to sort of bring Kim Jong-un not only into the international arena, but to make some sort of big offering that he is sincere about getting rid of his nuclear weapons. I do think a lot of progress has been made. I think anybody who's read the Bob Woodward book over the last couple of days realizes how close we were to being on the edge of a nuclear war. And that war would have seen Seoul be obliterated, which where I'm sitting right now, that city would not be here if those events had happened. So I think we have to really look at the progress that really has been made. And I think actually this summit is going to be a success. It's going to be a three-day summit. The South Koreans are bringing 300 different people with them to the gathering. The heads of a lot of the big South Korean conglomerates like Samsung are going to be in Pyongyang. That tells me that something is afoot. Now, there's been other summits. There's been two this year. There's one in 2000, another in 2007. You know, a lot of people have said that those summits were just photo ops and talking shops. I disagree. Anytime that you can try to bring North Korea into the international arena to lessen the chances of war, I think is good. And I have a feeling that what will come out of this summit is because Donald Trump is having problems domestically with the Mueller investigation, he's going to be looking for a legacy builder. He probably also understands that he's in trouble with China and China placing lots of pressure on North Korea. And I have a feeling when you put all these things together, I have a feeling what could come out of this is movement towards a peace declaration. And I think that would be a big win for Moon and for Kim, but also for Donald Trump.
What about denuclearization? Where does that stand after the summit?
I think denuclearization is going to be a very long slog. I don't see it happening within a year, within 2 years. The big challenge is we don't really even know how big the North Korean nuclear program actually is. You look at different evidence, there could be hundreds, maybe 1,000 or plus more buildings. They could have as many as 65 nuclear warheads. They could have over 1,000 missiles. If we're talking a program on that scale, you would be looking at a few years at best with complete cooperation from the North Koreans. And I have a feeling Pyongyang is going to want a concession every time it gives something up. That would be a lot of concessions. So I have a feeling over the long term, I think the United States is going to move towards denuclearization with North Korea. I think the North Koreans are going to make some steps in that direction. But we're talking a process that is going to take years. And I think we need to wrestle with that fact.
Harry Kasianis is Director of Defense Studies at the Center for the National Interest. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. It was 10 years ago that financial services from Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, widely viewed as the start of the 2008 financial crisis that ripped across the globe, resulting in what economist Shane Oliver calls the global financial crisis. Oliver, the chief economist at AMP Capital in Sydney, Australia, says the crisis first developed in 2007, but notes after the Lehman collapse, financial markets went into a tailspin over housing-related loans in the U.S. and the packaging of those loans on an international basis.
And, of course, that packaging up into what was called securities, of course, went with a lot of gearing or debt as well. And so when the U.S. housing market started to turn down and many home borrowers couldn't service their loans and those properties hit the market, prices fell, then a lot of that debt collapsed in value, leading to a lot of uncertainty about who was exposed to that debt, which ultimately culminated in the demise of Lehman Brothers on September the 15th, 2008. And of course, that was around, or that ushered in, the worst period of the global financial crisis. It's often called different things in different countries. Where I come from in Australia, it is referred to as the global financial crisis. Many Americans, though, refer it to as the Great Recession, given that it was the worst recession since, of course, the depression of the 1930s. But pretty tough times. And, of course, as we went through the worst of it around the collapse of Lehman Brothers, it led to a bit of an existential crisis concern that the global financial system, as we then knew it, would never be the same again, that it would usher in a totally different era to some degree, which is what we've seen over the last decade.
Now, there is a lot of debate here in the U.S. about what caused the global financial crisis, or the GFC, and how it began. Particularly, was it a policy failure when lenders made housing mortgages available to people who couldn't afford them?
That, to me, I think, is one of the biggest problems that led to the GFC. There was a policy focus at the time to make home ownership broader, available to more Americans. There was talk about the democratization of finance, you know, moves to end the discrimination that seemed to exist in lending at the time. And, of course, the financial industry came to the party by thinking, well, if we can make these loans to what at the time were called subprime borrowers, often people who didn't have a job or may have previously been bankrupt or had various other problems. But we can make those loans to those people if we then package them up together with lots of other loans. And because they're all unlikely to default, they went to the ratings agencies, organisations that put ratings on the quality of this debt. In many cases, they were given AAA ratings, which gave the impression to borrowers that they were perfectly safe. Of course, all of this was very much an artificial construct. The debt was far from safe, and the people that had been lent the money didn't have a great ability to service their loans. So when you sort of trace all that through, there was mistakes on the part of, obviously, the home borrowers, thinking that they could service these loans when they clearly couldn't, policymakers for encouraging lending to people who perhaps should never have got a loan, the lenders for undertaking the risks in the first place, the ratings agencies for handing out AAA ratings, the regulators arguably were asleep at the wheel, and of course for investors for piling into these debt, thinking there might be some sort of free lunch. I can get a great high yield, but there's no risk. And of course there was a lot of risk. So I think blame can be spread around to a lot of groups in the community. I wouldn't blame just one group, but I do think one of the lessons from that period was that the memory of, say, the Great Depression had long been forgotten. You know, when we went through the Great Depression, there was a lot of regulatory oversight as we went through the post-war period, but by the time we got to the 2000s, the problems of the Great Depression had long been forgotten about, and of course regulation became a lot more relaxed, ultimately, which led to the risks that we saw.
Oliver also said, given the creative destruction of these economic forces which give us these bubbles and crashes, another financial crisis like the one in 2008 are inevitable, but history, he says, indicates that it would not be the same as the one before. Shane Oliver is the chief economist at AMP Capital in Sydney, Australia.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
When Hurricane Florence came ashore in the southeastern United States Saturday, it brought with it high winds, a storm surge, and tons of rain, and much of that rain continues, and this could contribute to making farmers the hardest hit by this storm as it continues its path across much of the region. VOA's Bill Gallo spoke with one farmer in the state of North Carolina where Florence made landfall.
You see the leaves on the ground? You can see them leaves. That's where the wind has blown them off. You see this right here? That's what we call bruising. Now in a few days, that'll be brown.
About $500,000. That's what Kent Revels stands to lose in tobacco crops if the rain from Hurricane Florence doesn't stop soon.
Not going to be a good situation at all.
Florence hit at a particularly bad time, tobacco harvesting time. Though he tried to get everything harvested ahead of the storm, he only got about 60% done.
Well, it's going to be at least probably 4 to 5 days before we can get in the field. So that's just going to add to the deterioration of the crop. You know, I mean, it maybe even by that time, it may not even be harvestable.
It's too soon to tell what the total damage will be statewide. One local academic said the losses could reach $300 million, in part because the storm is moving so slowly.
Maybe even billions. I mean, I can't put a figure on it, but statewide in both states, North Carolina, South Carolina, it could be billions of dollars, just in agriculture alone.
Kent has crop insurance, but says it will probably just cover his expenses, making this a bad year.
It's a whole lot like gambling. That's what it is, gambling. Yeah, you invest and plant a crop and hopefully harvest and make a profit, and sometimes you don't get to the end. Sometimes the harvest is interrupted by a storm.
Bill Gallo, VOA News, Fuquay Arena, North Carolina.
And still ahead, the sounds of Barry White. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Soon after a global dust storm on Mars began at the end of this past May, NASA was forced to suspend the science operations for their Opportunity Mars rover. Since the 14-year-old rover is solar-powered, the dust storm blocked the sun's rays from reaching its solar panels, cutting off its supply of power. The space agency now says its Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter tells them that the dust storm has been steadily dissipating and more sunlight is reaching Opportunity's solar panels. Hoping to revive the rover, NASA has increased the schedule of sending commands to it from 3 times a week to numerous times each day. John Callis, Opportunity Project Manager at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, says if no response is received from the rover within 45 days, the team will have to assume that the dust and the Martian cold have caused some type of fault that will not allow it to recover. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know what? Right now, it's time for something from the world of music.
We got it together, didn't we? Nobody but you and me. We've got it together, baby. My sun, my moon,
Barry White was an American singer, songwriter, musician, record producer, and composer. A three-time Grammy Award winner known for his distinctive bass baritone voice and a romantic image, often narrating parts of his songs, such as "You're the First, the Last, My Everything." Your love I'll keep forevermore. You're the first, you're the last, my everything. Barry White's greatest success came in the 1970s as a solo singer and with the Love Unlimited Orchestra, crafting many enduring soul, funk, and disco songs, such as his big hit, "Can't Get Enough of Your Love, Babe."
It's just not enough.
Oh, oh, babe.
Oh, babe.
My darling, I can't get enough of your love, babe. Girl, I don't know why. Can't get enough of your love, babe. Lord, some things I can't get used to, no matter how I try. It's like the more you give, the more I want. And baby, that's no lie. Oh, no, babe. Tell me, what can I say? What am I gonna do? How should I feel with everything in you? What kind of love is this that you're giving me? Is it in your kiss or just because you're sweet? Girl, all I know is every time you're here, I feel a change, something moves. I scream your name. Look what you got to do with, darling, I can't get enough of your love, baby.
During the course of his career, Barry White had 106 gold albums and 41 platinum. He had worldwide record sales in excess of 100 million and is one of the best-selling musical artists of all time. While most of Barry White's successful recordings were originals for him, he had a huge success singing a song Billy Joel took to the top of the charts, "Just the Way You Are."
I never take anything for granted. Only a fool maybe takes things for granted. Just because it's here today, it can be gone tomorrow. And I guess that's why I cherish you so much, because you haven't changed. Baby, you're still the same. You're just as sweet, you're just as beautiful as ever. You know, I'm a little old-fashioned. I guess you could call me a little traditional, because I love things to stay like they are between you and me. And that's one thing that you'll never in your life ever have to worry about me, if I'll ever change towards you, because baby, I love you. Girl, I love you. Just the way you are.
By the age of 16, White had fathered two children with a childhood sweetheart, Mary. They were married by the time he was 19 and had four children. The couple separated in 1969 and later divorced. And in 1974, White married singer Glodine James. They had four children together. The couple had been separated for many years prior to his death, but they never divorced.
trying some new fashion. Don't change the color of your hair. Hey there, you always have my unspoken passion. Although I might not seem to care.
Mary White, who was born in 1944 in Galveston, Texas, and died in Los Angeles, California, at the age of 58 in 2003, as the result of a severe stroke, often said his influences included Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, Elvis Presley, The Four Tops, and Marvin Gaye.
I want you just the way you are. I need to know that you will always be the same old someone that I do.
I'm quite sure it doesn't get any better than Barry White. Absolutely none better. I think I have all of his albums, or close to it, anyway. What did I pay for them with? My Visa card, of course. Hey, listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington hoping you have a super Monday. Here's some more from Barry White.
I could not love you any better. Yeah. I love you just the way you are.
This is Today in History. On September 17, 1630, the Massachusetts village of Shawmut changed its name to a better-sounding Boston. On this day in 1787, the U.S. Constitution was completed and signed by a majority of the delegates attending the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. The document was then presented to the legislatures of all of the 13 states for ratification. On this day in 1814, Francis Scott Key presented his poem, Defense of Fort McHenry, later to be the lyrics of the Star-Spangled Banner, that song later becoming the national anthem of the United States. September 17, 1862 was the bloodiest day in American military history. During the U.S. Civil War, the Battle of Antietam in Maryland was tactically inconclusive, but Union troops did end the northern invasion of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. The losses in the one-day battle were staggering, nearly 23,000 dead, wounded, or missing in 12 hours of fighting. On this day in 1916, German air fighter Manfred von Richthofen, better known as the Red Baron, for the first time received credit for shooting down an enemy plane during World War I. On this date in 1976, the U.S. space agency NASA publicly unveiled its first space shuttle, the Enterprise. The Enterprise never flew in space, but did help scientists understand the shuttle's suitability for flight in the atmosphere. In 1978, the Camp David Accords were signed by Egyptian President Anwar el Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin following 13 days of negotiations at the U.S. presidential retreat Camp David. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.